questions on assignments 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, or 8?
One smaller and one more elaborate.
A small question? That was in your email. FD.set directory.
Okay.
And what?
You have to read the directory string in a different format, right?
The directory string, if you use the get properties user directory in double quotes, system.getProperties, and then user.dir in double quotes, then you'll get back a string in the correct format. But if you...
System.getProperties in double quotes, user.dir.
That will give you back your home directory in the right format. If you use fd.set directory, well, you can say user dir equals system.getProperties,
okay.
And then you can just say fd.set directory and put whatever the variable is that you assign to the return from user dir. I think I have an example that I did of that last semester. Was that the easy question or the hard one? What's the hard one? Put them into the same directory, into the same folder as everything else, or else you have to edit the class path variable. Which is in the, you're using Windows?
Yeah.
Okay, well, when you go into your autoexec.bat, and there's a class path in there for the Java classes, and you just add that onto the end of it, wherever the jar file is. That's it. That's all there is to it. Yes? Again, I'm going to explain assignment 8 again because it really takes a couple of times to get this polymorphic stuff. Once you know it, it seems easy and obvious, but getting over the, it's not. And I understand that. It's one of the most often missed ideas, which is why I save it for last and we have some days to do it. Put it in as a string. Put the directory in as a string. Yeah. Ah, but you see, that's what I told you when I showed you how to use the file dialog. Getting all the backslashes and everything correct is a pain in the neck. I know. You put two, you put three, you try two, you try three here and two there and one there, and it's a pain in the neck. But when I start up the computer later on, at the break I'll see if I can find the example I have of going through directories, and then I'll show you there. Okay. Yeah. Oh well, you don't connect it to the add window. You don't add it to the close box. You can call dispose to get rid of a window. You can just close it. You can call hide, like mf.hide, if mf was a myframe object or a frame. Just say .hide, and that turns it off. Then you can say show or set visible true, set visible false. But hide is the old way to do it. The new way is set visible false, and then it makes the window disappear. No. Yes. If you put a new line in it, you'll get a little square box. You saw that, huh? You were just testing me to see if I knew that. I'm sorry, you have to use a text area to get two lines. I'll do that, but I'm going to do the polymorphism first. So, what's the idea behind polymorphism? How does it work and why do we want it? Saves time. Writing code. Okay, the basic idea, I have a hierarchy. I made they're roundish objects, but they're still objects. Okay? There's the object class. Let me show this in relation to the two-string method, because that's one that we get. The object class has a method in it called two-string. You guys have actually seen the output of that sometimes by accident. What's the object two-string method do? What's that? It converts the address of the object to a string. So you'll see something like A3FF or whatever, with a 0x in front of it or somewhere, you know, if it's a hexadecimal. Okay, it has a two-string method in it. Then I have a person class and a student class and a grad student class. And what I can do is at each level of this, I can write my own two-string method. And you guys all know that, and that is called what? Overriding. So the two-string method is, if the grad student extends student, hierarchy, and grad student extends student, and student extends person, and person extends object. This two-string method, if I have a grad student variable, is the one that gets called for the grad student. And if I have a student variable, I get that one. And if I have equals new person p dot two string. If I haven't defined a two string method anywhere, I get the one from the object class. Because you know from inheritance that you inherit any variables and methods which are public, protected, or package access down through the hierarchy. You all know that, right? Yeah, that's from assignment 3. If I write a two-string method in the person class, that overrides the object two-string method, and then when I call p.toString with a person object, I get the person two-string method. And what we did is we created a little two-string method that just strung first, middle, last name together, just so that we could see that it worked. And then I created a two-string method in person, which took first, middle, last name and added the ID number to the end of it, so that if I made a student object, here I'll make student X equals new student, and I say f.toString, that'll give me the student version of it. There's no problem with that, right? If I didn't define one in student, I'd get the person version because the student inherits it. So that's easy and understandable, and it goes back to assignment 3 again. Now in assignment 8, what I can do is instead of saying person P equals new person, I can say person P equals new student. Why can I do that? What allows me to do that?
Student is a type of person.
Right. Student is a type of person. And the rule is, if I have a hierarchy and I have a variable which is of some type from that hierarchy, I am allowed to assign to that variable both that type and any data type below it in the hierarchy. So a person, see, a person is the superclass of student, student is the superclass of grad student. Therefore, if I have a variable of type person, I am allowed to store a person there, or a student, or a grad student. If I have data type object, what am I allowed to store? Any of those, person or student or grad student, because the whole hierarchy extends from object. So object is kind of a wild card class. If I have a variable of type student, what am I allowed to store in a variable of type student? Student or grad student, that level or below. Okay, that's rule one. Rule two, if I have a method in my hierarchy, in one of the classes in the hierarchy, and that method has the same interface, what's a method's interface? It's access specifier, it's return type, it's name, I'm moving from left to right, it's name, and any arguments that it has. That's the interface to a method. If I have a method in the hierarchy, in multiple levels of the hierarchy that has the identical interface, so in this case, the two-string method is, oh look, blue, public void toString, and no arguments. Okay? So if I have a method which has the same name and a matching interface, then when I store objects from the hierarchy into one of these superclass variables, in this case I have person, P equals new student. So P in this case has a student object in it. And I say dot toString, p dot toString, the runtime engine automatically gets the toString method from whatever kind of object is stored in that variable. So in this case, the code would call the student toString, even though if you looked at the code superficially, it looks like it would call the person toString. It doesn't. It switches automatically and calls the correct method for the correct class that's stored in it. If I stored a grad student in there, it would call the grad student toString method. I could change the data type of P to object, and as it turns out, object has a two-string method with that interface. I can store a student or a person or an object or a grad student in there and the correct two-string method. There's four different choices and the runtime engine will figure out which two-string method I want. How does it do that? Right. What actually gets stored in those are addresses. And the addresses point to a method with a certain kind of interface, And all the runtime engine cares about is that the method with that interface is available. So it doesn't look into look as, you know, the runtime, it can't really look, it's just a machine. It doesn't look any more deeply than that. It says, oh, object in here, two string method, great, I'll go get it. So when you compile your program, the correct method with the correct interface is in the object, right? These all have a two string in it. So no matter what object is in there, it's going to go to the right place because this is just an address. P in this case is just an address of an object. So it's either going to be the address of the object class, the person class, the student class, or the grad student class, and the method with that interface is there in the right place. Because every one of these classes actually can be taken apart. We'll see with Java Beans this week that we can take apart a class and find everything about it. All its methods, all its variables, all the access specifiers, everything is in there and available to the runtime engine. That's a nice feature because it allows us to write a generic program, in this case a generic program to deal with some generic attributes of people, and then create some special purpose methods for special kinds of people. That's what Mr. Rogers said, but he's retired now. And I don't know if our specialness went with him or not. Does that make sense? Did I explain it? Or not? Or you have to try it to see. Remember the sample program I ran last Thursday that had a person, a teacher, and a student, and I had a method for displaying their data? And the method had the same name, called displayInfo, and in the person case it displayed the name, address, and city, state, zip. The teacher, same thing, along with a list of classes. Student, same thing, with a student ID number. The important thing there was displayInfo was the same name, the same return type, the same access specifier, the same arguments. And I had a readInfo method that was identical. It looked identical on the outside, it behaved differently on the inside. All Java cares about is that it looks the same on the outside.
If I remember correctly, you used the paste statement or paste switch to determine what kind of object was created.
To decide which kind I stored in there.
Right.
Yeah, there's lots of different mechanisms you can use.
That part is traditional, if you will.
Right.
As opposed to the,
right,
the rest of the book, would it be zero?
Right.
This
is called polymorphism because this variable P can take on many different forms. Polymorphism means many forms. So, this variable P can take on many forms. This line of code p.toString can do many, many different things. It can do as many different things as there are objects in Java.
In class, like the
right. Right, so that they're interchangeable. Now, the important thing here is that the superclass has to have the method in it, even if it doesn't do anything. So, for example, in my person class, in my demo, I had a method in there for readInfo, but it didn't do anything. It was just there to provide an interface, to provide a model. And then the subclasses can, or but they don't have to have that method in them, because with a subclass, if it doesn't have that method, it uses the one above it. The important thing is that the superclass has to have it. Otherwise, you get an error that says, I can't find that method. If I wrote this code and there wasn't a two-string method, in the prison class, and I tried to do this, where I said equals new student, and student had a two-string method, the compiler will give me an error, because the compiler checks the data type of the variable to look for the two-string method when you're compiling it. It doesn't say, oh, I'm going to use this, I'm going to put a student in there. It doesn't do that. So that you have to have the method in the superclass. Even if the method in the superclass does nothing. Which object, yeah, that tells it what kind of object is stored in there. But see, when you run this program, you can run it in a generic way. Where you don't know at compile time what kind of object is going to be in there, and the code will still work. That's why it's powerful. Because I can decide at runtime, I can push a button and tell it which kind of object I want. Right, I could have an interface. Button of some kind, and then I click on one of those and it goes, oh, you want a new one of those, okay. This code here stays identical. So I can make 36 people, or I can make 36 students, or I can make a person in 35, or whatever, and it'll still work. And the example we had was vehicle, which was load, go, stop, unload. That's the same method for everything, no matter what kind of vehicle. Right. If it's not in the class, it has to be in the superclass.
And it
would
still run it.
Oh, yeah. Sure. Yeah, because this if the student class doesn't have a two-string method, it'll use the person one. Right, if person doesn't have it, it'll use the object one. If object doesn't have it, it won't compile. Yeah, stubbed out, which is this. That's when we say stubbed out, for those of you who don't know, that's what that is. It's a method with no innards. If I have it defined like this, with a semicolon at the end, what's that called? Quick, this is on the final. What final, you're supposed to say? That's an abstract method, which means I've defined the interface to it, but I haven't defined it in a useful way. That is, I am not allowed to make an object of whatever type this is in. What error do you get when you try to compile code where you have something like that in it? You guys know because you got it last week.
That was last week.
You get blah, 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 should be declared abstract, because you haven't implemented method such and so. Or you will get an error that says, I can't make an object of that type because it is an abstract class. Well, if you're not using implement interface, if you have a class with an abstract method in it and you try to say, person P equals new person, and it has an abstract method, and it'll say, that's an abstract class, you can't make an object out of it. What you do is at the top of the class, you say public abstract class person. And then you avoid getting the warning message from the compiler that says you should put the word abstract there.
What's the point of abstract class?
Well, you define an interface. Let's say a vehicle. Let's say I make a vehicle class, and all I want to do is I actually want a vehicle to do anything. It's just a generic vehicle, and So I create a whole bunch of methods in it that I say, if you guys make a vehicle, it's got to look like this. And that forces anyone who makes a vehicle to provide those methods.
What would happen, if I understand this, is that you create a vehicle with stop, go, turn, whatever, right? And they're all abstracted. If we try to create a car that extends
vehicle, you've got to implement all of those.
To implement all of those.
Correct.
Well, we can stump them out at that point.
Yes. They don't have to do anything, but they have to be written and included.
Basically, that force is the same grammar as in that you're...
Right. It's a design tool, especially if you're working in a group. You don't have to implement it. You can still extend it, but you have to write, physically provide the code for all of the methods, or... whatever class you wrote is also abstract, and then whatever you extend from that has to have them written. And on and on and on. It's a design tool. Nothing we do in this class requires that. Right? So we don't spend much time on it, because the only thing we do is we have a bunch of interfaces that are abstract, and we have to implement those, so we see that. But we aren't working in a big group on a project where things have to fit together. But if you were working in a group on a program where everything had to come together at the end, then you would use tools like that to say, okay, you have to extend this, and then your code will work with the rest of the people's code.
Right. Interface,
right.
Right. One guy writes 2 SDRs and a guy
with a string. Any of you guys, if you have worked on a software project with a gang, where everybody is allowed to do their own thing, integrating it is a nightmare. Because you have to ask everybody all the time. You have to, well, how did you do that? Well, how do you call it? And so on. So then you say, well, is it easier to do that? Or is it easier to have somebody at the beginning make a design, provide everybody with the abstract classes, and then everyone is forced to use the same tools. So, when you see the Microsoft Foundation classes in C++ and so on, that's what that's all about, is so that it'll work with the operating system. Same thing is true of the Macintosh interface and so on. If you want your code to work with the rest of the application, you have to write it in a certain way. The Macintosh has an additional strength, which is what? They have published something called the Human Interface Guidelines, which means that when you have an application and it has menus and so on, there are certain ways that those should behave. So that when you use it in one application, you use a menu called such and so, and you go to a new application, the menu called such and so begins with a certain set of tools. And when you push the tabs on the little tab keys, they don't rearrange themselves as they do in some operating systems. So that every time you push a tab, all of the tabs are in a new place, and you're going, oh, well, now where? And if you don't believe me, I'll show you. Yes. Correct. Yeah, but you saw that there was one place in our code, in the get number class, or one of those, where we actually used an abstract class, where we called get instance of. And what that allows you to do is it allows you to use the methods that are in there without actually having an object of that type. What a world. But that's all for, you know, in the fall. For those of you who take advanced Java. Advanced Java. Because I'm the teacher. They used to have a guy that was going to teach you who actually knew what he was doing, but they put me back in it. So. But that... No, I would have been very happy if he had done the class. I would have been good for the students, and that would have been good for me. Because I would get to be home one more night a week. So I could help the kids do their homework. I don't know. We'll see. And how many of you guys are taking advanced Java? Thursday night from 6:30 to Squintillion. I don't know. They have a new schedule where it just goes on and on and on. You never get to go home. I don't actually like the new schedule. You guys tried the new schedule yet?
Yeah.
It's like 6:30 to 10 or something.
That's all part of the lab room, right?
It's in a lab, thank goodness, yeah.
Tell me how far it will be.
What?
Tell me how far it will be. And look at what? You two get together,
because you don't do that. You come here. And what is it? My family is safe. Well, let me just say that a half hour longer is like saying that, you know, a climb is only a half mile farther. Yeah, so 7 minutes shorter than I'm really exaggerating. Yes. It's in fall. Yeah, in the second session I'm sleeping for 6 weeks. Like a polar bear. Actually, I'm making up what we're going to do in advanced Java because I don't know what we're doing. Okay. I don't know. I refused to teach it last spring because I was burned out. So it was in the schedule, but I said, Other questions? That finished the polymorphism? Okay. Aren't the rest of you that didn't know what it was about from last week, aren't you glad to hear it again? Yeah. I thought so. Because assignment 8 is one of the most popular ones. Just pay attention to this now because it's important advice, because we only have 3 weeks left, which means what? 3 days. Assignment 8 is the most popular one to get back with me saying, no, that's not polymorphic.
If that happens,
and if it happens on Thursday night at 9:11, well, you can be here Friday morning, but I won't be here Friday morning. So make sure that you do your assignment 8 sooner rather than later. Thursday night, remember, that's the special night where all we do is go to the lab and finish up our work. So I'll be sitting in the office with George Garibian, and you'll be coming in and I'll be going, nope, that's not polymorphism. And I said, nope, that's not polymorphism. Same time. The absolute deadline is 10 after 9 on Thursday. And hopefully I'll have all the grades done on Friday, and then I'll be on break. And you'll send me email, and I'll answer it on September 4th. Oh, what a cool guy. Okay, other questions on assignments 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8?
Event handling.
Mouse stuff. Okay, what's the general model for event handling?
Implement.
Listener, add listener, method, okay? So, the methods have an event argument. Okay, so whatever kind of listener, a mouse listener, you implement mouse listener, you add mouse listener some object, and the object that you add has to be a mouse listener. How does it become a mouse listener? By implementing mouse listener. Does add mouse listener have to be in the same class as implement mouse listener? No. No, I could add the listener over here. The methods have to be in the same class that implements the listener. So if I implement mouse listener, then the mouse clicked and mouse released and whatnot, those all have to be in the class that implements the mouse listener, and the compiler will insist on it. But I can be over in some other class and I can say add mouse listener, you know, something dot add mouse listener, and then whatever this class is, I'll call it ML. I put ML as the argument, and now that is listening to the mouse over here. So I can have what? I could have a window, and I could have another window, and I could have another window, and I'll call the windows A, B, and C, and window A could actually be listening to the mouse over in window C, and it could be listening to the buttons in window B, and window B could be listening to the mouse in window A, and so on. You can mix and match these things totally.
If you have a method operating in A,
well, what I would do is in B, I would say add mouse listener A.
Right.
In C, I would say add mouse listener A. Then, when the mouse did something in B, A would respond. When the mouse did something in C, A would respond. As I added it. The important thing here is that A has to implement mouse listener and have the methods. The only problem you have with that is that then they can't extend frame. So, so what you do is you make this an interface. If you make that an interface, then I can implement that interface in A, B, and C. But then I have to actually write the methods.
What's an interface? What
have I forgotten? That's like an action listener, a mouse listener. That's exactly what you do. With mouse listener, you say implement mouse listener, and then you provide the code for the method you want to overwrite. Now, what they have done for you is they have created some handlers, like the window handler, the mouse handler, which have implemented all of the methods as stubs, and all you do is override the one you want. And an example of adding a listener with a handler with an overridden method is from back from the assignment where we made the frame and said add window listener, new window handler, public void window closing window event E. Let's look at that code again. Right, this is the code we've been cut and pasting. So that's the add code. The add code takes an argument, which is a listener. Okay, in this case, add window listener, I have to have as the argument to that method a window listener. Okay? Well, imagine that somewhere else in my code, I'm just going to go over to the right here, which is somewhere else in my code. I write window handler, WH equals okay, so window handler. What is a window handler? Well, a window handler is a piece of code that's very familiar to you. Public class window handler implements window listener. Okay? So if it implements window listener, then it has to have a bunch of methods. Public void window, what is it? Window open, window event. And that's a stub of code, right? Public void window opened window event E. Public void. Well, you can see how much time it takes to write this, right? Window closing window event E. Another stub. And so on. There are six or seven different window methods that are required to implement window listener. So what the people in Java have done is they created this handler class that implements all of those methods for you. Right? And then if you extend window handler, what you can do is you can just write the piece of code you want. Or the one that you want to override. Or, and I'll put dot, 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 meaning that there's five more methods there that I didn't have ink enough to write or board enough to write. Or what you can do is you can create what's called an inner class. How many of you guys downloaded the inner class handout and looked at it and read it? Well, it's available to you all summer long. So whenever you want, you can do that. Okay, add window listener needs a window listener, and you can see window handler is a window listener. Fair enough? Any problem with that? What I'm allowed to do in Java is create an inner class. And what an inner class is it's a class defined inside of another class. So if I'm in class MyFrame, and I compile MyFrame, I get out, the output from the compiler is MyFrame.class. I have a file MyFrame.java, it compiles to MyFrame.class. If I define a class inside of a class, and there are rules on how to do this, and that's what that handout is all about, then what I get is a file called myframe$1.class. And every time I define a new inner class, I get $1, $2, $3, $4. So if you actually look at the output on your disk from your assignment 5, you will see like myframe.class, and you'll see myframe$1.class on the disk. This is where that comes from. Add window listener, new window handler. Right? That's the argument to, it's a window listener. Window handler is a kind of window listener. And then what I do is open curly brace, and I write public void window closing window event E. That's this code right here from the window handler class. What I'm doing is I'm overriding that one. So I'm creating a new version of the window handler class called myframe$1. It has all of the methods from window handler, but what I did was I changed the window closing to exit. So I said system.exit0. Close curly brace, that's the new method. And then I have to close curly brace to close the window handler class. And then I close parentheses semicolon to close the call to add window listener. So you could do the same thing with the mouse handler. Any other handlers there are. You simply say add mouse listener, and then say new mouse handler, and then any mouse events that you want, you can define one after the other here, close the curly brace, close the parentheses, semicolon, now you've got. Now the question is, who is listening to the window? Is my frame listening to the window? No, the window handler object is listening to the window. If you create a mouse handler, it's listening to the mouse. But because it's an inner class, you can see the mechanisms described in the handout, call the methods and use the variables of the class that encloses it according to certain rules. So you can read up on those if you want. It's a way of saving you work when you go off and you have things listening to mice and listening to windows and listening to buttons. Yeah. Yes, you could do that too. Well, no, because window listener is an interface. Sorry, the reason that they gave you window handler is because window listener is an interface and it's all abstract. And so on. Yes, sir. No, because window handler did it for you. That's what these dots are. That's why you use window handler. That's why they wrote it. It's because people got tired. They said, look, come on, I've written this stupid thing 100 times and I'm writing it again. So they said, well, we'll make a window handler and that'll handle it for you. And then in 1.3 or 1.4, they said default close operation, and that goes out and it does everything for you in one line. So you don't have to do this kind of, this is a little hard to remember. Yeah. Yeah, well, window listener is an interface. So you can't new it, because it's abstract. See, this class here is a class. It's implemented it so you can create an object of this type, but you can't create an object of window listener type. Because it's abstract. Exactly. That is the generic method. Add listener, and then just throw in any old listener. Well, that is it. See, what you can do is you can actually go out and create a window handler class for yourself called My Window Handler that implements those things. And then you can use it over and over and over again in your code. And then all you have to do here is put the variable name, My Window Handler. Not megawatt hours. Oh, John Sachs is in here. I'm an electrical engineer who, if I did that, he did. That's my unit. No, because all of the listeners have different interfaces, right? They all have different methods. I mean, you could write a piece of code that listen to everything and have a generic thing, but which I'm sure people do, right? That's where they came up with this set default close operation. Well, you can use a variable name in its place, and you don't have to repeat all that stuff. Right? It's not. This is an inner class. See, I'm actually defining this class right here. That curly brace and that curly brace say I'm defining the class at this point in the code. This from here to here, that's the inner class. And it's just right. Yeah. Then I would have an inner class, and then I could just call it by its name here, WH. Right. Yes. Yeah, and you'll see, and if you look at the handout that I made up, I have a button handler that I use as an inner class. And if you look at the inner classes code that I have on the iDrive upstairs, I actually have a set of 5 windows, and they all have inner classes, and they actually use the inner classes between the classes, and it's very confusing, but it shows all of the different ways of using an inner class. So, because you can use these inner classes if you have a variable defined as your inner class, you can actually use them from outside. But the syntax is really odd. In fact, the syntax is so odd that if you look at the example for inner classes on the iDrive, if you try to compile it in JBuilder, the inner classes actually show up as red, meaning that the JBuilder can't find them, but it all compiles and works. So it can't find it, but it can find it, so to speak. So it's very peculiar. Right, that's what those dollar signs are in the file names, right. Okay, on that low note, let's take a break. What I was hoping to do, and we may have time to do it, is give you a brief introduction to JDBC, because it's such a useful thing to know about. So take a break. When you come back from the break, I will do a quick diagram, and then I will switch to the machine and just show you an example of it in action. Okay, let me explain this, what I'm going to show you, and then I'll show it to you. So, JDBC, that's Java Database Connectivity. So, it's a way of sending SQL, Structured Query Language, which are simple text string queries to a relational database, and then retrieving what is called a result set. And the result set is a collection of all of the records from the database that match the query. So you ask a question to a database, it gives you back the answer. The answer can come back as a very large data object. Potentially. Right. So, there are two kinds of interfaces to these databases, what are called native interfaces, and then there are, for example, the ODBC, Open Database Connectivity tools that Microsoft provides. Okay? So, you can either do JDBC directly if you have a native driver for your database, and the database can be a text file, it can be an Excel file, it can be an Access file if you're on Microsoft, or on Microsoft Fox Pro, another, or DBase. They all have ODBC drivers for them. If you're working with external databases like Oracle and Sybase, or MySQL, which is a free relational database that works on very large data sets. These people have native drivers. Native drivers are faster than ODBC drivers because with the ODBC drivers, you have to go from Java to ODBC to the database. But with native drivers, you just go directly to the database. The connections to the database are made via a URL object. Some of you discovered last week that files and URLs are different. They're almost the same, but they're different. They're slightly different formats. File names have like C:// blah, blah, blah. A URL will have file:// and then the directory. Okay, but a URL can also be what? It can go off to anywhere on the internet. When you realize that you can go off anywhere in the internet. You realize that you have to have a database server running for Java to connect to. Java can't just connect to a database. It has to connect to a database server. That's what the driver is for. The driver serves as a bridge between Java and the database server. Okay? So when you watch the steps here, realize that even though I'm doing the steps on a local machine, I could literally be going anywhere on the planet that has a database server that has my username and password that allows me access to it. In advanced Java, what we do, hopefully we'll still be able to do it, is we run a MySQL server on a Sun machine that's up on the third floor here. Our lab is over in the San Gabriel building. We actually connect via the internet to the database that's running on the Sun machine and send queries to that database and bring the data back across the network, and then you can actually run it from home or anywhere on the planet. In fact, I had someone on the other side of the planet try it once just to prove that you could do it from the other side of the planet. So, first step, you have to have a server. Okay? If you have a Windows machine and you have Office, for example, it comes with a Java, if you have one of the 2000 or 98 or 95 versions, it comes with a Java server, the ODBC, JDBC bridge, and if you have XP with Service Pack 1, you also have it. Okay, so the first step is to make sure that you have a database that is being served up. This is not Java. This is Windows establishing a service connection. So I go to the control panel, and one of the control panels is ODBC data sources. So I open up the ODBC data sources, and these are the databases that I've set up to connect. And if you look at the configuration, see, here's the name of the database source. I just make that name up. And then this shows you that the actual database is on C:\, blah, blah, blah. There's some subdirectories, databases, address book.mdb. It's an access database. Okay? The one that I use in the demo is, actually I have, there's several different demos, including the one from the book, where they make database tables, which is a very slick thing. Java has the ability, has a class called an abstract table model, which allows you to take your result set and convert it immediately into a multi-column table with the correct headers and formats and all of that, because these databases have the metadata being what's the format of the column, how many records, blah, all that stuff. The data about the data is all stored and retrievable, and you'll see that in here. But for this demo, I just have a little simple file, and the name of it is dbpaneldata. That's the name I gave it. The actual file name, I use that configure to select the file. And then I say, okay, attach this file to this name. And the reason I'm showing you the name is because you'll see it in the program. You'll go, where did that come from? This is where it came from. So I made a connection. I said, okay, I'm going to be using the JDBC, ODBC, Java Database Connectivity, Open Database Connectivity driver as my bridge between my Java program and the database server on Windows. Okay? So, none of this stuff works if you don't set up the database file first with the server. Now the server is serving up my file. Okay? Step one. Now let's go to our program, and what I'll do is I'll go to the part where I connect. Let me just make sure. I think it's DB panel 3 is the one I'm using here. Okay? This is the physical piece of code that is the actual driver that I'm going to use to make the connection. What you have to do is you have to, for whatever database you're connecting to, you're going to get a source file, which is the driver that connects Java to that kind of database. In this case, there is a folder in my Java directory called sun.jdbc.odbc, and then this is the actual class, jdbcodbcdriver.class. If you go out on the internet and get one of these things from the internet to connect at work, let's say you work at a place that has Oracle or whatnot, then you actually go through a step in the properties where you go out, and in this example, I have a MySQL driver. So what I had to do was I had to build a path to it so that if I wanted to use the MySQL database up on the Sun upstairs, I include it as one of my project properties. I have to have somewhere a path to the driver. Fortunately, if you're on Windows and you have any of the Java version on Windows, they come with, as part of the Sun standard package, JDK 1.x, they come with a JDBC ODBC driver for you. And the JDBC ODBC driver connects to all of the different Microsoft applications. Okay? So, this is just, you have to have a statement that says, this is the driver I'm using. See, it's just a string. It's just a file name. It's a string that's a path to the file. Okay? Here's the data source. JDBC, ODBC, DB panel data. That's the location of the file on the server. This is actually in URL format. When you build these URLs to connect to databases, you will see there will be something like MySQL colon. Just like HTTP colon. So this is the headpiece of the URL to get to that data. It says go to the JDBC ODBC server on this machine and connect to the file that I've set up with the name DB panel data. So I showed you in the control panel this is where I connected to it. Okay. When you actually do the code to do this JDBC ODB, oh, and look, I've also included up here is SQL. That's the system, the structured query language statement, and the JDBC ODBC are in my path so I can do all of the things I need to do. Okay, here's a connection. That's going to be where I attach the driver to the actual database. A statement. That's a Java class that allows me to send my questions to the database. And a result set, that's the answers back from the database. Customer data is a class I created to hold customer data. And here's how I actually connect to the database. It's pretty straightforward once you know what all the pieces are. If you don't know what all the pieces are, it's just about impossible. When you first start off doing this, if someone hasn't explained it to you two or three times, you're left going, this doesn't work and I don't know why. Because there are so many steps you have to go through to get it set up. Once you know how it's set up, it's actually very easy. Because you go out and you get the driver. Here's how you load a driver. Class.forName, and then you give it the string. That's the name of the driver class you want. there's the connection. So I send a URL, there's a driver manager class, get connection. And then I give it the URL to the place where the database is. If it's something that requires a username and password, there's a method that allows you to do that with the username and password, which are just strings. I go out and I create a statement. What's the statement for? The statement is for talking to the database. That's it. Then what I did is I make up a query. These SQL queries are all simple strings. No matter how complicated it is, and any of you guys who know SQL know that you can send requests for ranges of records, you want them back sorted, then they meet certain criteria and so on. You can make very, very complicated statements. They all go off in the form of a string. You can create tables, select tables, you can open different multiple databases, you have multiple connections all over the world, on and on. Yes, it's as simple as that. Okay? I want to get the data. What I do is here's the statement object I created. I say execute query. There's the query string, whatever it is, simple string, and it gives me back the result set. Result set includes the metadata. In this case, what I do is I ask it for the column count. How many columns are there in the data set that I just asked for? And then I just go through. rset.next is just like string tokenizer, next token. It simply says, give me the next record. So I go through the records one by one, and in this case, it's a very simple thing where I actually know the structure of the database before I get it back. And I say, okay, put the customer data record number in the first, and so this is, I'm just building the customer data, first name, middle name, it's all, it's pretty familiar, huh? I'm just pulling it out of the result set. So the result set gives you back a record, which is the person's name and their address and so on. I put it into a customer data object, and then I add the customer data object to a vector. Then I close the result set, close the statement, close the connection after I've loaded the data. Okay. Now notice the names of these methods, because what these are is this is actually includes a demo for those of you who want to go get it off the disk upstairs, a demo of polymorphism. And I'll just show you quickly how this thing runs so that you can see. Okay, I have a couple of windows. Here is, once again, it's a generic window. This is just like the teacher, student, person window. It's a generic window. Down here I have a radio button that says, do I want customer data or supplier data? Two different kinds of data, two totally different classes, two kinds of objects, but they all have load, open file, and so on, common methods, which means I can use a polymorphic program to access the data. So I say I want customer data, I push the load button, and up pops the data. What it did is it just went out, it connected to the database, read the records, returned the result set, and I can go through the result set. I can generate, in this case, a query, an SQL query. These are choice gizmos. Remember the choice things? Okay, what I did is I went out and I got the metadata. The metadata included the names of each of the fields in the database, and I put them into a choice thing. So if I change the database and add more fields, it'll still work. These are the SQL operators. See, so I can pick one of these things here, and what I can do is I can make a... So customer ID not equal to 3, I push enter, And you see the number down here turned from 7 to 6. I generated a new query to the database, give me all the records except customer 3. So instead of getting back 7, I got back 6. Eh? How easy can life be? And you can go through, you know, edit these things and save them, update the database, do all the different commands that you can do in SQL from a Java interface. The code to write the interface, you guys already know all this. This is nothing you haven't done. So the only thing that's new is learning how to do those 3 steps, right? To load a driver, connect to the database, and get a statement object back that allows you to send queries to the database. Once you know how to do that, then you're in Java database heaven. Oh, then you have to learn SQL if you don't already know it, which you can go out on the internet and there are teach yourself SQL tutorials. MySQL.org, yes. Who are the same people who wrote MySQL, which is the free relational database. It does big-time databases for small-time. How much does Oracle cost these days? Bazillion dollars. How much does MySQL cost? 0. Which is the one you want to choose? 0 is a good price. Don't ask me how they do it, but they do it. I don't know, the same way that Linux survives and all the other things that are written for free. It's a miracle. Well, with new Oracle, I know that they have all native Java interface, so it could very well be that. But the actual database engine itself, I don't think that Java is fast enough to do it. I think they use C++. Is all Java. What a planet. So now you guys have seen it. The demo is up. Digest it for a while, and then if you have more questions about it, I'll show you the MySQL version tomorrow. In the meantime, it's time to get to work. Assignments 6, 7, and 8. If you've already done 5, I think most of you have. 6, 7, and 8, you want to really get done by Wednesday, so if there's anything you haven't got done, you can do it on Thursday. Yes, it's under DB panel on the iDrive.